and ugly. Every once in a while, just to make sure his dad saw, he pulled out the paper and looked at it. But he no longer needed a scouting report. It was going to be all junk all the time. Heading into the top of the seventh, Macon clung to that one-run lead. Then, a strange thing happened. Mighty Lane Tech, not Macon, cracked under the pressure. Of all people, Jeff Glenn laid down a perfect bunt to start the inning, right off the third base line. Kreiklowek, the reserve catcher, got to it in time, but launched the throw past the first baseman, allowing Glenn to reach second. Then Ronkowitz uncorked a wild pitch, prompting Papsiak to stalk to the mound. He signaled to a relief pitcher, Jim Owanski. But Owanski fared no better. Again and again, the Iron Men ran. Poor Walt Kreiklowek. Not only was he unaccustomed to playing this much, but after 2 hours in that heavy catcher's gear and the thick heat, he was absolutely gassed. Wild pitches in the Chicago City League merely caromed off the backstop 10 feet to the rear. Here at Minden Field, they skittered to the distant collegiate backstop. When Kreiklowek did catch the pitches, it seemed a runner was always going. 3 times he made throwing errors trying to nail all those dancing, sprinting Ironmen. As he did, the runs started to pour in. 3-1, then 4-1, now 6-1. All Henneberry needed to do was shut down Lane Tech in the bottom of the seventh to send Macon to the state final. There was only one problem. Now it was Henneberry who started thinking about the magnitude of the moment. He plunked a batter with a curve that never curved, gave up a double, then walked a batter. Soon Lane Tech was down only 6-3. Worse, the bases were loaded and there were no outs. The time had come for Sweet to make the long walk to the mound. Slowly, head down, he strolled out. The crowd stared. Henneberry stared. Sweet reached his pitcher and cleared his throat. "So, everybody's looking at me like I'm supposed to come out here," he said. "So here I am." After a moment, Sweet patted Henneberry on the shoulder and walked back to the dugout. Then motioned not to Schartzer, but to Jimmy Durbin, the tiny freshman with the jug ears who hadn't pitched the whole season. The kid who could barely get the ball to home plate on a straight line. "Get up and start throwing in the bullpen," Sweet said. Durbin's face registered shock, followed milliseconds later by fear.
"Me?"
So dutifully, Durbin jogged down the right field line to begin warming up. Behind him, 1,971 fans watched in astonishment. Sweet was thinking of bringing in another pitcher, and it was this kid? Where was Schartzer? What in the name of all that was holy was this hippie coach thinking? Back on the bench, Sweet grinned. More important, with every looping warm-up pitch Durbin heaved, so did the Iron Men players. For Sweet, moments such as this were both the most difficult and most crucial times to reinforce his ethos. Otherwise, it was easy to succumb to thinking that the game was more important than it was, and lose one's identity. On the mound, Henneberry stared in disbelief. Durbin? Then, as he watched the kid tossing lollipops, Henneberry realized the message Sweet was sending. He had the utmost confidence in him. With that, Henneberry felt a surge of energy. Rather than trying to muddle through, he decided to go for broke. Climbing back on the mound, Henneberry proceeded to unleash a half-dozen gorgeous curveballs, the kind that peak near a batter's ear and then plummet to the dirt. He allowed one run, but more important, struck out 2 batters on 3-2 called strikes. And thus, the moment, his moment, arrived. With the score 6-4, he faced left-handed first baseman Jim Owanski, who was 1-for-3 on the day. Henneberry wound and kicked, his arm out at that familiar three-quarter angle. At the plate, Owanski tensed his body. He knew what was coming. Everyone at Mine and Field did. It didn't make it any easier. Iwanski had been taught not to swing at curveballs until there were two strikes, for the best that could happen was you hit it hard on the ground. But with Henneberry, he knew all he was going to see were curves, and anyone who's played high school baseball knows the sweating nightmare that is hitting a vertiginous curveball. Someone with professional quality heat has a reputation that precedes him, allowing batters to stand farther back and choke up. But a curveball pitcher is a terrorist who can come from anywhere. So even when Iwanski saw Henneberry's hand fall from behind the pitch, seeing the magic trick before it was performed, he still had to override his instincts. The ball was floating in high and outside, but he knew it would not end up there. Iwanski needed to stay back, to swing at a place where the ball was not. Gathering his strength, he took a mighty cut. The pitch had dropped so far, however, that his bat caught only the very top of the ball on its descent toward his knees. Slowly, the ball bounced toward first base, right at Glenn. He caught it with his left foot already on the bag. There was the briefest of pauses, a millisecond during which a profound shift occurred for the boys in the Macon uniforms. Lives tilted. Expectations were altered. Legacies formed. After this, nothing would ever be the same again. Then, Minen Field exploded. Out they came, streaming onto the field. Girlfriends in short shorts, and parents and teachers and shirtless students tossing their hats into the air. The mad, crazy rush of a small town that suddenly felt big. Circling them all in great arcing loops, like some crazed valence electron, ran Cliff Brown, the giant purple M of his flag ruffling through the air. When it was over, Stu Arnold's four stolen bases had tied a record set by a boy named Lou Elke of Streeter High back in 1942. And Lane Tech had tied a tournament record with five errors in one half inning, three charged to Kreklowek and two to Ronkowitz. Papsiak was steamed. He grumbled and grimaced. When a reporter from the Journal Star asked him what happened, he said, "I don't know if it's Lane or me, but we never seem to come through in the clutch." Later, the players heard that Papsiak said he felt the team had let him down. On the field, the players lined up and shook hands. Knowing Lane's reputation, Henneberry expected the players to be bitter, or perhaps complain about how we should have beat these some bitches. They weren't. Instead, a couple of the boys said, "Great game." Another said, "We're hoping you guys win the title." Then the facade cracked. As Lane center fielder Richie Coleman walked off, he couldn't help himself, breaking down in tears. When Ronk saw him, he began crying too. He didn't care that the scouts were watching. It was prom night that evening back in Chicago, but Ronk wouldn't attend. Neither would he say a word during the three-hour drive back to Chicago. It wasn't supposed to end like this. For most of Macon, this was enough. This moment. Now the radio DJs would know where Macon was. Now there would be a story to tell the kids and the grandkids about how I was there the day Macon beat mighty Lane Tech. There was reason for optimism and celebration. There was a reason to be proud of being from Macon. As Falstrom of the Herald and Review would later say, that really felt like the championship game right there. As the students belted out the Iron Men fight song and reporters crowded around Sweet, ecstatic about the underdog story they'd just witnessed, one boy watched in horror, the elation seeping out of him. "Ah, fuck," Schartzer thought to himself. "Now it's on me." He looked at all the people going crazy over the win, at all that jubilation, and worried. This wasn't the championship. Why were his teammates and the fans acting like it was? How, he wondered. Are we going to get channeled and focused and ready for the title game? 19. One shot. It was time to regroup. Back at Joomer's, the players showered and stayed as close as possible to the AC, under strict orders from Sweet to remain inside. Meanwhile, Maxine Glenn and Georgiana Schartzer hurried to the laundromat with the uniforms. At 1 p.m., the team gathered for lunch in the hotel conference room. Mark Miller, normally the loosest of the boys, was so anxious he could only nibble at his food. The same went for Dale Otta. Presently, a skinny man with brown hair walked in. Most had met him before. It was Fred Schooley, Sweet's buddy from Champaign. Schooley was a savvy baseball man who'd played in the Eastern Illinois Semi-Pro League. A few weeks earlier, he'd driven down to Macon to help the team with situational fielding. On this afternoon, he came to offer information. Earlier that morning, Schooley had volunteered to scout Waukegan, which had whooped Rockford West 10-0 in 6 innings in the other semifinal, the only tournament game called on account of the mercy rule. Now he stood at the front of the room and looked at the boys. He wasn't going to lie to them. "You ain't going to beat them," Schooley announced. "There ain't no fucking way you can beat them." The boys stared, shocked. "They're like a minor league baseball team," Schooley continued. "They'll take the Commodores 2 out of 3. Their catcher is a first-round pick for the Pirates." He turned towards Sweet. "LC, he completely eliminates your running game." Sweet looked sick to his stomach. Everything his friend said may have been true, but it should have been relayed in private. A few feet away, Schartzer stared in disbelief. He liked Schooley and respected his baseball knowledge, but the guy clearly didn't know anything about communicating that knowledge. For one, he was selling the Iron Man short. Second, even Schartzer knew better than to say something like that in front of a bunch of young boys. Looking around, Schartzer saw that some of his teammates looked pissed. Others looked scared. Sweet cracked a joke, trying to reassure the boys, but the damage was already done. Delivery aside, Schooley was right. Waukegan was a powerhouse. While Lane Tech may have been the most talented team in the tournament, Waukegan wasn't far behind, and no one was better prepared. A factory town of 80,000 or so in the northern suburbs of Chicago, Waukegan was a conservative place, and the high school sports teams reflected that. A 2-year ROTC stint had long been mandatory at the school, and most of the players' fathers fought in World War II. The head baseball coach, a man named Jack Mallory, believed in structure and discipline. A tall, lanky man with a grandfatherly effect, he was both patient and persistent. His goal was for his players to become so well-versed in the game that they never had to think, but instead reacted on instinct. To enforce this, Mallory scheduled practices down to the minute, bunting at 3:12 p.m. in the northwest corner of the field, then pickoffs for pitchers at 3:17. The routine changed daily, and Mallory expected everyone to hustle between stations. He placed particular emphasis on situational plays. He wanted the boys to know exactly where to throw the ball in any given scenario, and split batting practice into multiple sessions, focusing on skills such as hitting the opposite way to advance runners. The system worked. Waukegan was a perennial power that came within one game of the state final in 1967. Even so, the 1971 team may have been Mallory's most talented squad yet. 4 players were named All-State, including star catcher Mike Aremovich. The son of a Marine sergeant, Aremovich had the whole package. He hit the ball a mile, ran well, and could throw a football 60 yards. He was, in every way, the team leader. Aremovich was the one who penciled in Waukegan State champs when Mallory tacked a 1971 postseason schedule on the wall at the start of the season. He was the one who called the guys at home and got them to the field on the rare Sunday Mallory didn't schedule practice. He was the player who had the crispest uniforms and the straightest edge to his pants leg. The one who taught his teammates how to sew elastic bands from old garter straps into the bottom of their pants legs to hold up their sanitary socks and stirrups. A trick his mother had discovered. In the eyes of the pro scouts, Maremovich was one of two or three surefire prospects at the state tournament, and his teammates had long since grown accustomed to seeing up to a dozen scouts at their games. These men loved Mike's size and power, and what Journal Star columnist Phil Theobald described as the howitzer hanging from his right shoulder. They also loved his attitude, not just the leadership, but the intensity. In the conference playoffs, Maremovich had broken a bat with his bare hands after striking out. Mentally, Maremovich had prepared for the chance to play Lane Tech. Then, on Friday morning, one of the coaches came into his room, where he and a few teammates were watching TV. "I've got some news," the coach announced. "Lane Tech lost to Macon." The boys were shocked. All Maremovich knew about Macon was that they were a tiny school, and their team had speed in center field, the big hitter, and the pitcher. He'd learned long ago never to take an opponent for granted, though. There would be no giggling about peace signs so long as he was on the Waukegan bench. By the time Macon and Waukegan took the field at 4:30 p.m. for the state final, the Iron Men had gone national. Charles Chamberlain of the Associated Press filed a story entitled, "At Macon High School, Baseball's a Happening." Chamberlain referred to Macon as a dot in central Illinois, noted that they became the smallest school ever to reach the finals in 32 years of Illinois high school baseball, and described the boys as a bunch of rock music lovers with long hair. He also mentioned Barb Jesse, the team's official scorer, who sits on the bench wearing a ponytail. While Chamberlain was preparing his story, the Macon fans had continued celebrating. With 5 hours to kill before the final, the teachers and parents did what any sane Maconite would do on such a heady day. They made straight for the cool interior of a bar. By the time they returned to Minden Field, they discovered that the 4 p.m. heat was even worse than the 11 a.m. heat. Keeping their energy up was going to be a challenge. Even so, most of the fans were alert enough to notice that, with only half an hour to go before the game, Macon's coach and star player were nowhere to be found. Not far away, Sweet and Schartzer fidgeted in Bradley University's training room. That morning's trip to wrap Schartzer's wrist had been a snap. This time, however, not only had the duo showed up late, but the process was taking longer. Still, Schartzer wasn't too concerned. He didn't need long to get warmed up. As the minutes ticked by, though, he began to worry about how the delay would affect the perception of Sweet. As the season went on, Schartzer had begun to feel protective of his coach. Sweet could laugh it off when people mocked him, but Schartzer took it personally. He knew everything Sweet did to help the team. How he understood which players to boost up and which to take down a peg with a well-placed joke. How he invited the team over to play cards at his trailer, and how he took them hunting and fishing, making them feel not like boys, but men. How when one of the freshmen got scared on an overnight trip and came to Sweet's door, the coach had invited him in to sleep in his room, even though Jeannie was there, and it was probably the last thing he wanted to do. When together, Schartzer and Sweet never talked of bigger picture topics. Still, slowly and subtly, Sweet pushed the boy. When Schartzer had gotten sick of basketball and decided he didn't want to play, it was Sweet who took him for a walk, leading him down to the gym, where he pointed at Arnold and Glenn and the others. "These are your teammates, Shark. They need you. Now get out there." Peer pressure didn't work on Schartzer, but this was different. This he understood. He rejoined the team that day. Over time, Sweet and Schartzer had become closer than most in Macon knew. Now they had a chance to do something special. Just so long as the doctors finished the damn tape job. At Minen Field, the minutes ticked by. Now it was 4:10, now 4:15. And still, the area player of the year and coach of the year were nowhere to be seen. What's more, Sweet had all the gear in his car. With no other choice, the Macon boys borrowed a couple of baseballs from a kid who lived nearby. Finally, fearing the worst, Jack Henneberry